get ready for an all-new Hardline segment. It's time to step into the Snake Pit. And now, with something completely over the top, the host and star of the Snake Pit, Snake.
Thank you very much. This is a very special Snake Pit, and one that I've been looking forward to for about 3 months, because I found out a couple of months ago that we were approaching the anniversary of something that is near and dear to my heart, and I think forever will be. And that is the epic, epic horror film, Silence of the Lambs.
Oh.
It turned 30 three days ago, as it opened up over the Valentine's Day weekend back in 1991. Low budget, which seems weird looking back at it at the time. Very little fanfare when it was released. Weird time to have a movie release, Valentine's Day. Think about that weekend releasing that movie. It went on to sweep the 1992 Oscars. It became the third film in the history of the Oscars to win Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Screenplay.
Wow. How about that? What did it cost to make that?
You know, I don't know the total monies that it cost, but you look back at it and you think Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Demme, who, you know, the three monsters.
Box Office Mojo claims $19 million was the budget.
That's unbelievable. Unbelievable. It went on to make about $300 million worldwide. Not much that first weekend, but it became a word-of-mouth thing. So before we get into this, I wanted to go back and listen to what Siskel and Ebert said about this movie.
Awesome.
Siskel and Ebert, for those who don't know, they could shape a movie one way or another. They were two movie reviewers, from one from the Chicago Sun-Times and one from the Chicago... What was the other one?
Sun-Times or Tribune.
Tribune, yeah. And they would host a show every single weekend. They would pick three or four films. They would review them. And it was must-watch TV.
They were the gold standard. I mean, if you thought of movie reviewers, they were the ones.
They were it.
It was them, and Bobby Wiegand.
Again, armed with the information that I just told you, the third film in the history of the Oscars to win Best Picture, Director, Actor, Actress, and Screenplay, here is what Gene Siskel had to say about that movie.
Bill, isn't it?
I'm afraid I can't tell you any more about that.
That's Jodie Foster as an FBI trainee on the trail of a serial killer in The Silence of the Lambs, a depressingly brutal thriller that I found completely lacking in redemptive quality. So I sat there thinking, why are all these talented people involved in this project? There is a sporting quality to this story that I found distasteful. Eventually, Silence of the Lamb degenerates into a standard monster in the house movie as Foster catches up with Buffalo Bill in his dungeon-like home, where a young woman is held captive and terrorized in a well. The horrors of female abuse are too much with us, I think, now to be trifled with anymore in the movies. We had this complaint about the picture involving Julia Roberts. I have it again here. I didn't learn a thing about serial killers from this movie. A much more honest, less exploitative film on the same subject was last year's Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. By contrast, The Silence of the Lambs is a star-studded freak show directed by the usually enormously talented Jonathan Demme, who I think for the first time in his career has picked a surprisingly trashy project.
Well, this is a tough film to review because, of course, in terms of its subject matter, one can easily target it as you have. And also, I think that the ending doesn't really work. Once she gets into the house of Buffalo Bill, it does become standard. Who's behind this door? Who's going to jump on me from the shadows? The first part of this film, though, Gene, is terrifically effective, partially because of the real tension, the dynamic interaction between Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins. It's one of the most peculiar and fascinating relationships I've seen in a movie in a long time. Hopkins is very good here. Foster is very good here. The dialogue is at a very high level of intelligence, and the movie works not perhaps in the same way as Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, but effectively. And I think that you're really shortchanging a lot of skill and craft and art that went into this film.
No. You know, sometimes you say, I think you blew it on this one. I think you're being too easy on this picture in this way. He is presented, the Anthony Hopkins character, is presented as this big evil thing, and we're going down there to see them, a journey into hell and all that. And frankly, he was so pumped up, and the music was so pumped up at such a high level.
It worked for me.
Well, then you're easy, because for me, I thought, oh, come on. A guy who's truly frightening doesn't need, a huge organ playing in the background. I didn't buy it at all.
This is the movies. What did you want? A documentary, black and white, television, shoot it on video?
No, the reason why Henry, the Portrait of a Serial Killer works is because these people, my intuition, I don't have any first-hand knowledge, these people tend to be kind of dull.
Well, they're two different kinds of movies, and you're using one to criticize the other.
Yes, we always do that, Roger. We say better picture than the same picture.
Why can't you criticize this on its own terms instead of saying
I'm criticizing on its own terms. I didn't, wasn't compelled by anybody except, I suppose, the Jodie Foster character as a strong woman.
Come on, a great performance.
Not a great performance, a decent performance. I thought that was way overplayed.
Damn.
Dude, is that awesome. Not unbelievable?
That is
it's like Chuck Cooperstein reviewed the movie, you know? Like, I've never met anyone who flat out disliked that movie. And here, again, this is way a year before the award season. The guy that everybody pays attention to hated it.
Dude.
Is that not amazing? Here's something that, you know, back at the time, back in 1992, when you think of horror movies, and this was a horror movie. This was categorized as a horror movie. But it changed everything because for years and years and years, for two decades or a decade and a half, horror had devolved into Friday the 13th and Halloween and Freddy Krueger, Nightmare on Elm Street, all that crap.
Don't confuse horror with slasher.
Yeah, but no one had made anything smart like this concerning a horror movie since The Exorcist came out in, like, you know, 1974. And so this was, when people heard that this was some sort of horror flick, they thought, bah, whatever, you know, how can this be any good after Jason and Michael Myers and Freddy Krueger, not knowing that this was art. This was like high art for its time.
This was such a game-changing movie. Like, there are very... I'm positive there's a time in your life where movies can change your game on a level like this, but I would say, with the possible exception of Pulp Fiction, this is the one that I didn't know what to expect going in. I probably had nothing going as a 19-year-old, or I guess an 18-year-old. Went to it, and that's all I could think about for a long time, so
dude,
I kept going back to it. I feel like I watched it three times in the first week.
I know. I'm the same way. I mean, there are very few movies that I walk out of just going, oh my God, what did I just see? And you can't get it out of your head or anything. And
Gene Siskel is kind of right in a way that it is a pretty cliched ending of the there's a scary man in the house and he can't really see him.
Sure.
But I think he just took that part of it independent of the rest of the film, because when you factor that into the rest of the narrative, it works perfectly. And then the fact that they added, which at the time I'm assuming was pretty fresh technology, with the night vision goggles and incorporated that into it, which gave it such...
Ugh.
I mean, it took the element of fear exponentially up. When that component came into play, it was like, oh my God, that was S your pants horror suspense.
I've never been scared like that in a theater. Like, ever. You were freaking out. Think about this, too. Anthony Hopkins is Hannibal Lecter. I mean, outside of Vader, greatest villain of all time, right?
Yep. Yep.
He was on screen in that movie 16 minutes of, like, a 2-hour and 20-minute movie.
Well, how long was the actual serial killer, the one that is the object of the entire show, how long was he on camera?
Buffalo Bill?
Less than that, I bet.
Oh, way less than that. Absolutely.
That's part of the brilliance in this film, is you don't really even interact with the main characters that are evil, diabolical people that much at all.
So Jonathan Demme took a page out of Spielberg, and before it, you know, because there is gore, you see Hannibal the cannibal do his thing where he's chewing up people, basically. But before it was all about, like, Jaws, where it was... theater of the mind. Theater, yeah. You know, for, you're scared of the unknown. And so the buildup before Clarice meets him in that jail cell, the buildup was just, who is this guy? What the hell? I mean, you keep hearing story after story from the Jack Crawford, her boss over at the FBI. And then once she gets to the insane asylum to meet him for the first time, this is the story that was told. And this is 30 seconds before you see Hannibal Lecter for the first time. These are the rules about confronting him in his cell.
Do not touch the glass. Do not approach the glass. You pass him nothing but soft paper. No pencils or pens. No staples or paper clips in his paper. Use the sliding fruit carrier. No exceptions. If he attempts to pass you anything, do not accept it. Do you understand me?
Yes, I understand, sir.
I'm going to show you why we insist on such precautions. On the afternoon of July 8, 1981, he complained of chest pains and was taken to the dispensary. His mouthpiece and restraints were removed for an EKG. When the nurse leaned over him, he did this to her.
You don't see the photo. She's looking at it.
The doctors managed to reset her jaw, more or less, save one of her eyes. His pulse never got above 85, even when he ate her tongue.
So...
Okay.
You're armed with all of that, and it's brilliant because, I don't know if y'all remember this, and I watched this again last night. Like, I cannot tell you how much it holds up, but that whole walk through the insane asylum,
yeah.
They keep going down, 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 like stairwell after stairwell. So you're like going into the depths of hell
right.
Before you meet this dude. And, you know, everybody talks about the MIG scene.
I don't know that everybody does, but our station has certainly been obsessed with it over the years.
Yeah.
30 years.
For sure. But the insanity of the MIG scene. As she is walking down the hallway of all these insane human beings, and she has this conversation with Lecter. She walks out of there, and as she does, this guy is nude. He's pleasuring himself, and bad things happen. To Clarice because of this. And then Lecter, in this insane moment, just listen to how insane this is, Lecter is screaming at her to come back.
This courtesy is unspeakably ugly to me.
Then do this test for me.
No, but I will make you happy. I'll give you a chance for what you love most.
And what is that, Doc?
Advancement, of course. Listen carefully. Look deep within yourself, Terry Starling. Go seek out Miss Moffat, an old patient of mine. M-O-F-E-T. Go
Doctor.
Now. I don't think Mix could manage again quite so soon, even though he is crazy. Go now!
And she runs back out past mid. It's just, it's sheer insanity. What's going on down there at the bottom of the, whatever that prison is that that he's trapped in? But,
yeah.
You know, the stories of Lecter, the stories of Anthony Hopkins and how he came to define that role, it's he wanted to be like, if you remember 2001, A Space Odyssey, the computer Hal, that just mm-hmm. talked like this. How are you doing today? Like, that's what he was trying to emulate, really. And again, he's in it for 16 minutes, and all 16 minutes of him in that are just over the top crazy. And then to have that supervillain like Buffalo Bill, who's skinning people, that's the thing. You don't really know who's the worst bad guy. Is it Anthony Hopkins or is it Buffalo Bill?
Right.
Like, who are you rooting for less? And that moment in which I thought this was like the most brilliant part of the whole movie is at the end, before that scene that we were talking about with the night vision goggles, mm-hmm. when they set it up like Jack Crawford calls Clarice and says, we got him. We got the address. We're going in right now. And she says, well, I'm going to go clean up this little interview that I have with this neighbor of one of the victims. And he's like, okay, Clarice, good job. And so they set it up, making it look like the FBI is going in to capture Buffalo Bill. And at the same time, Clarice is ringing this doorbell of this crazy guy, and you don't know which is which. And then when they realize that they have failed, they're gone. They went to the wrong house. Jack Crawford, you hear in this clip, say, oh, my God, Clarice.
Good afternoon. Sorry to bother you. I'm looking for Mrs. Lippman's family.
Everybody get out!
No, Lippmann's don't live here anymore.
Excuse me, sir. I really need to speak with you.
Clear! Clear! What's the problem, officer?
Well, I'm investigating the death of Frederica Bimmel.
There's no one here, Jack. Clarice.
Your name is?
Jack Gordon.
Mr. Gordon. Good. Well, Frederica used to work for Mrs. Lippmann. Did you know her?
No, uh-uh. Oh, wait. Was she a great big fat person?
Yeah, she was a big girl, sir.
Yeah, I read about her in the newspaper. Mrs. Lippmann had a son. Well, maybe he could help you. I got his card in here someplace. So, do you want to come in while I look for it?
May I?
Yes. Sure.
Thank you.
So she walks in there, and then all hell breaks loose. And as she walks in, everybody, because you're already, you know who he is. Everybody knows who he is. And then when she slowly starts to figure it out, and she uncocks her holster to grab the gun before he pulls the business card trick. Man, all of it is, it's so tense. It's so great. It so holds up. And it is, for the 50th time that I've seen this, it is still terrifying.
Yeah,
100%.
Go outside. Once she saw the moth and all of that, why didn't she just run out and leave and call back up?
The trademark scene that sticks with me though is him in that publicly displayed cell situation. Is that at a courthouse? Why is he at the pinnacle of the movie? Why is he
being
like
transferred?
I'm trying to remember the circumstances, but I can see the scene in my
when he
in
kills
my head
the cop
so
and kills about three other people.
Yes,
you're talking about Lecter, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
He's being transported. The governor of Tennessee is going to come talk to him about her missing daughter, because the daughter that's in the well is a politician's daughter,
right?
And so he's being transferred to talk to her, and you know, again, I don't know why they had to. I mean, this is pre-internet and all that, but. Yeah, that's his escape. Everything, and you look at it and you realize that every single move that he made was to get to this specific point to escape.
Yes. And everything. He had his music playing or something.
Yes.
Or
had classical music played. Yes. You had lamb being served to him.
Right.
They afforded him a lot of amenities, man, to get him to help solve this crime.
Yes.
Last question, before we have to get too far here. Is there a line, like, slightly younger than us, where people after that just have never gone to see this movie because it's not... like Mino, are you familiar with this movie?
Oh, yeah.
Beyond the Station?
This is one of my favorites.
I think
this holds up over time with younger people.
Yeah, I was just... I don't know if the next generation watches this movie as one of the movies from 1991 that you have to see, but maybe it is.
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think this is like, you know, movies that we were told to see from the 60s and 70s that, but better. Like, instead of, you know, a 70s, a Godfather that you probably could have cut 45 minutes out of, there's not 1 second of this film that needs to be cut.
No, like, you don't need to trim the fat on this thing.
No, it's
there
all incredible.
Any.
And, you know, the fact that the story of the guy that plays James Gunn, Buffalo Bill... of him getting into character and, you know, Jonathan Demme warning him, like, this may define you. This may follow you around forever. And he's like, I don't care. I want this so bad. I mean, dude, that guy, wow, is he crazy.
And but it came in under 2 hours, Corby.
Oh, it did? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought it was 220.
Oh, did you see an extended version? I see it at 118.
Maybe so. I don't know. Well, whatever the case, it turns 30. It's Silence of the Lambs. So
good
enjoy.
Stuff. Corby Davidson.
All right. Good stuff. Let's dive back into Snowmageddon.